12:09. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. Hi, I'm John Williams. Pete Zimmerman's our producer, and we're here Monday through Friday on the Wintrust Business Lunch from noon to 1. Anna DeVlantis after that. It's been a long, old trouble. Among our conversations today, the Art Institute's opening back up. How do you go to that? How do you do that? We told you on this show not that long ago about the Shedd Aquarium opening. We talked about the Field Museum. The Art Institute's turn today. We'll catch up with Amy Allen, the Vice President of Engagement at the Art Institute. Stick around for that just a little after 12:30. Right now, we start with David Beckworth, the Senior Research Fellow at the Mercatus Center for at George Mason University, a former international economist at the U.S. Department of the Treasury. You can visit mercatus.org. Thanks for joining us, David. How are you today?
Great. Thanks for having me on the show.
It's nice to hear your voice again. We've talked to a number of quote-unquote experts on the economy this week, and a lot of attention was obviously on the tech companies. I suppose that's on your radar, too?
Sure. It's an important part of our economy, and what happens to them happens to the rest of us, indirectly, if not directly.
And I was talking to somebody the other day. They said that when you look at the Dow and some of these indices, it's actually sometimes just a handful of companies that are driving it. It's Google, it's Amazon. Maybe they aren't perfect arbiters of how the market is doing overall, or the economy for that matter. Do we put too much weight when we look at the markets into just a handful of companies?
I think that's a possible problem for investors. If you're thinking in terms of policies, what we should be doing, then yeah, I don't think the stock market is the economy. The economy is much broader than just, you know, these few influential firms in the stock indices.
At least they're doing well though, right?
Oh, certainly. Yeah, this has been a great time for them. In fact, after their hearing this week, their stock prices shot up, as you know. So this has been a great time for them. I mean, there's controversy, but they seem to be doing relatively well during the pandemic.
Why did they go up after the testimony on Capitol Hill?
It's not entirely clear. I mean, no one knows for sure why these things happen. My sense would be they've, you know, better established themselves. They have a better footing going forward. But I don't think anyone really has a clear answer.
I suppose it was that they sort of dodged that bullet. I mean, you know, some of them did better than others, but I didn't see any table pounding where we discovered, by golly,
right,
they're corrupt and they're going to go down.
And I thought, you know, Amazon looked really well. I mean, the testimony given by its chairman was, I thought, outstanding. So I think they've, again, firmly kind of established themselves. They're not going to go anywhere. It's not some big scandal. I mean, there's bigger fish to fry for Congress right now. The economy in general is you know, it has tanked, as we learned yesterday. And we think it's going to do better this next quarter, but there's still some grounds to worry. Things do look a little bit shaky in July, and we never know what's going to happen if new fears about the virus cause further concerns among spenders.
Yeah, you've got the second wave coming in one direction and then the hope for a vaccine in the other. I was having some negative thoughts the other day, and they were this, that one of these trial runs that we're investing billions of dollars and putting our hopes in comes up negative. It falls so short of expectations that it's not going to reopen the economy, and I think the markets, as well as, you know, employment, would react to that.
Oh, absolutely. And there's that factor. We might be disappointed, but there's also the factor that we're still in a big, big hole in this economy. You know, we lost 22 million jobs in March and April, and May and June we've gained about 7.5 million back. So there's still a big hole to fill with employment. There's still around 30 million people who are on all forms of both state and federal jobless insurance. Of course, some of that will run out this week. But there's still a huge, huge hole in the economy. And I think that hole by itself is going to put us in a tight spot for the rest of the year, in addition to being disappointed by what happens with vaccine.
How do you suppose, then, the posture that we're in, that everybody's in, should impact the way we deal with China? That was, boy, on everybody's front burner before the pandemic, you know, trade with China. How does that change things?
In my view, I think it should put a back burner on things for a moment. We have enough things going on. Our plate is full. I mean, policymakers' plates are very full just trying to get through this health crisis, which is also an economic crisis. And then why on top of that do we want to rattle things more? And I think, you know, that was a big issue before. It's going to be a big issue going forward. But I would do, if I were in President Trump's shoes, I would do what I could to kind of minimize that distraction right now. We need all hands on deck with this public health crisis as well as the economic crisis.
One last thing for you then. Are you on board a second round of stimulus checks, $1,200, or another round of unemployment benefits, the boost of $400, $500, $600?
Well, let me say this. All the evidence shows that the concerns about the unemployment insurance, the added ones in the federal level, hasn't really hampered people going back to work. There are definitely here and there stories you can tell. But if you look at, for example, all the people who were hired back, the 7.5 million, many of them, one study found 70% of them was making more with their unemployment insurance than what they got going back on the job. So there's a number of studies that show that in practice it hasn't been a problem. And that's because, again, the economy, the hole is so big. And my worry is if we suddenly cut it off, it probably will lead to some drastic results. I do think, though, over the long run, you do have to phase it out. The long term, definitely, I think it's a big issue. But a sudden cutoff probably is not in our best interest.
I think that is so interesting. I have not heard anybody quote that while, yes, there are people that are making more money on unemployment, given the opportunity, people still go back to work. By the way, I presume that has something to do with health care coverage as well.
It does, and people want to work. I mean, people want to get back to normal. But think 7.5 million folks have gone back to work, and 70% of them were making more on unemployment insurance, all their benefits, rather than work. Another indicator that supports this interpretation is if you look at indicators of job vacancies, so employers who pay job vacancies, if these benefits were truly keeping people back on a large scale, you'd see a big spike in that, but we haven't seen that either. So I there's trade-offs here. There's definitely a distortionary incentive, but there's also this need to help, you know, the economy as a whole. So again, I think you don't want to do a sudden cutoff. You want to maybe plan to phase in a sudden drawdown, but make it gradual, make it predictable, give people time to adjust.
David Beckworth is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Really interesting. David, we'll call again. I appreciate your time.
All right. Thank you.
There was a story in the Chicago Tribune not that long ago by Ryan Ory about COVID-19 and the concern people have about the air conditioning and heating systems in buildings spreading the virus around. Forget about plexiglass between you and me. What if it gets into the air conditioning system? At the same time, late in his story, Ory writes, after working from home, 65% of respondents said they wanted to return to their office sooner rather than later. Yeah, I guess I'm not surprised to hear that. So now the hot topic is, this is, as Ori points out in the story, kind of an obscure thing that you and I didn't used to think about, the HVAC system in a building, but now people are very interested and concerned about this. My son pointed this out to me because he works for a company called The Hill Group, and it's a mechanical engineering firm that concerns itself with HVAC issues. And Jim Kamalis is on a phone line. He's a vice president of engineering there. Hey, Jim, you're on WGN. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
So is business good for you guys? Is this something you've been doing all along, or is this kind of a new wrinkle in your business?
Well, business has been, especially in this area with concerning indoor air quality in buildings, it has a new heightened awareness, so people are much more attuned to what is going on in their buildings or what should be going into their going on in their buildings. So as far as business in that area, it's been good. It's been a lot more activity, a lot more questions being asked. We've been helping people try to reduce the risk and help ensure that their buildings are safe for when they do return back to work.
Well, is there a certain kind of technology, or is there something different, filters? I mean, what can you do to ensure that the virus doesn't spread around so much?
So the basic recommendations out there are to, number one, increase your outside air into the building to as much as the system can accommodate. That'll help dilute the particulates within the space. The other recommendations are to run your systems longer. For example, have the fans circulate longer periods throughout the day, just to help improve that circulation. And then with that, with increasing the filtration in the units, you're increasing the amount of times that that air will pass through that filter. So we're looking at trying to increase the dilution in buildings, increase circulation, increase filtration, just to help if there are those, with those particulates, just getting them out of the space. And then those are just simple things that a lot of buildings can have done.
Right.
And sometimes some buildings are a little more complicated, a little more sophisticated, so making those changes aren't so easy. Just to say that you're going to go in and I'm going to open up my outside air, fresh air, to 100%, it'll have other impacts in the buildings in terms of maintaining temperatures and humidity. So we always recommend consulting with professionals and technicians and helping customers evaluate that. But then above and beyond that, there are some technologies. I don't want to say they're emerging technologies because the technology has been around for a while, but they're newer to us taking a new look at them just because they're probably things that we hadn't really strongly considered in the past, but they are helpful in addressing or dealing with or reducing these particulates and reducing the risk of spreading pathogens throughout spaces.
Yeah, I want to ask you a little bit about that, but let's just go back to those other two points you made a moment ago. Yeah, we could probably run the fan more, and we could probably even open up some windows, get some fresh air in, or maybe it's the ventilation system that's actually drawing the air in that is within the HVAC system. So I think a lot of businesses can just do that. But I'm wondering if businesses are thinking about, no, that's not going to get it done, because like you said, maybe that's going to screw up the temperature or the humidity, and it's an unpleasant workspace. So are businesses like retrofitting their HVAC systems then to circulate the air better and keep it safer?
So there are, usually it's controls upgrades, it's balancing work, just to ensure things are operating properly and maintaining what you have or how the building should be operating. And on top of that, there are some devices that we're adding into these systems to help keep the air quality or keep the air clean. And there are devices from, and it depends on the situation, depends on the installation, the application, but the devices go from UV lights, and then bipolar ionization is another one that's become very popular. So other types of active filter, active particle management, which is electromagnetic filters, or creating electrostatic fields around the filters to help improve the efficiency of filters. So
yeah, stop right there. Is that something I can get? I've heard about that, electrostatic, that it literally, gosh, somebody was telling me that like 99% of the particles that go through this filter get pulled off electrostatically. And I'm like, okay, I'll have one of those. Is that just something that we put inside the filter space, or do I need to get a whole new system if I'm going to do that?
It can be retrofitted. And they're not the typical electrostatic filters of the past. They're a little more sophisticated. They produce an electric charge on particles to help them combine and agglomerate, and then also help the filter be more efficient. The other one with bipolar ionization will have similar effects by helping particles agglomerate and also help the filter system become more efficient. Some of these systems then, for example, like the bipolar ionization, will deliver the ideas to flood a space with ions to help not only agglomerate particles or particulates in the space, but also help neutralize pathogens and organic compounds or VOCs or pollutants in the space too.
Answer me this. Does this make any sense? I wonder if you could. I'm just talking out of my hat here. You can just hang up on me if you want to run away from this crazy idea, Mom. What if you could put something in the system that would circulate, I'm going to sound like the president now, some kind of disinfectant throughout the building? That is, rather than using the filter point to pull it out, use the whole system to distribute something that would disinfect the living spaces. How about that good idea?
And so... There is one of the newer technologies, or like I said, it's not newer, but it's been around for a while and it's been utilized a lot, is with bipolar ionization. And it has a similar effect with the ions that are intended to flood the space by delivering these ions out into the space.
Oh.
It's having a similar effect in terms of helping clean the space.
So what about the light? Is there also a kind of light that you pass through the air system that sort of disinfects or cleans the air?
Mm-hmm. So there is. So it's UV light, ultraviolet light, and it typically in the past you'd see these usually used as a coil or surface disinfectant.
Right.
And the way it works, just like your exposure to the sun, it's dependent upon time and intensity in terms of how efficient it will be. So using it in an airstream usually is a little bit more difficult because air will move past this light at varying speeds. So it's not usually the most ideal location to try to disinfect an airstream. You'll see probably there's new technologies being invented for devices, robots that might go out into a space when the space is unoccupied to do some off hours surface disinfecting or disinfection.
Right.
Using UV.
You know, I don't know. So we're in a building downtown where I'm on the 18th floor. We have one floor in this building. So we're tenants. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the landlord, if you will, the owner of this building is doing regarding these things. And I think it would probably behoove us to ask them, hey, how safe, how clean, what are you doing to maximize the safety of the air in this building since this is an airborne disease, COVID-19? It's, a whole new round of concerns, but maybe fronts to fight this on is maybe the more positive way to look at it. Really interesting stuff. Mm-hmm. Jim Camillus, thanks for joining us, Vice President of Engineering at the Hill Group. Visit hillgroup.com. No O-U in group. It's hillgrp.com. Jim, nice to talk to you today. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, John. Thanks for having us.
Yeah. We've told you about the opening of the Shedd Aquarium, which surprisingly to me was one of the first at the museum campus to open in Chicago. We talked about the Field Museum. Now it's the Art Institute's turn, and this is all good news. Amy Allen joins us, Vice President of Engagement over there. Amy, thanks for joining us. How are you today?
I'm so well. Thank you, John.
Yeah. Nobody has said that yet. I am so well.
We have talked here that we need to find something other than how are you.
Yeah, I know. I know. It used to be just an old hat way, but now it does give you pause. I've got to find another way to welcome people to the show. Well, welcome to the show, and I'm so happy that you guys are ready to roll, huh?
Yes, we reopened yesterday, and it felt great. You know, I think we were all laughing that we used to do this 7 days a week, and we're a little rusty right now. But honestly, yesterday was happy and a smooth day. We've been working on readying for the reopen of the museum for about 5 months now, and we were ready. It was time.
What was the day that you closed?
March 14th.
Yeah.
March 14th.
And so, well, I'll ask you about the exhibits in a minute, but let's just do some nuts and bolts. So noon to 8 Thursday and Friday, 10 to 6 Saturday and Sunday and Monday. Are you closed on Tuesday and Wednesday?
Tuesday and Wednesday, yes.
Was that normal or is that more for the hygiene of the building now?
It's a little bit of both. We wanted a couple days of space to allow our amazing facilities teams to really be able to dig into the building. And also, just as we were thinking through attendance patterns, you know, like so many of our counterparts, we are not only for Chicagoans, but also a tourist destination. And so we knew that we would have some less crowds. And so this was really a starting point for us to make sure that we felt that we had time to take care of the building and our teams as well.
What percent of capacity are you going to allow in at any given time?
We began with 25%, which, you know, yesterday we had just right around probably maybe 20 to 22% actually showed up for the day. And with 1 million square feet, you know, the galleries really feel expansive, and there's a lot of space for everybody to move around. And additionally, it enables us to, staff a little bit differently and ensure that we've got people placed in new spaces. So it felt good.
Some of your colleagues at the other facilities told us that they're seldom at 100% anyway. So while 20% sounds drastically less, it's not normally a lot more than, say, 50%. How much are you off what you normally would be on a summer day?
Oh, my goodness. Oh, I mean, probably at least two-thirds at this stage. I mean, especially in thinking through if you've got a major exhibition going. You know, I mean, it's drastically different from an attendance perspective, especially, again, with tourism really being shut down. But that being said, we're grateful to be able to get our legs underneath us and to really take time to understand how we're doing this and that we're doing it correctly. The safety of not only visitors and members but staff is our highest priority, and so I think that the pace of how we're going about this is really thoughtful and helpful.
Will I wear a mask the whole time? Do I need to make reservations online?
We do ask that everyone, it's required that everyone wears a mask when they enter the building, and we were grateful that everyone did so yesterday. Staff is doing the same. Yesterday through August 3rd, we are free to all Illinois residents, and so we simply ask that you go online and reserve a free ticket. And then after August 3rd, we're simply asking that everyone go online to purchase a ticket online prior to or renew their membership online so that when you come to the museum, you can have your member card out or your ticket ready. Simply walk into either of the lobbies straight up to scan yourself in at the podium, and it's fairly contactless, and then you're into the galleries.
Well, if I have a membership, then can I just show up, or do I still need to tell you when I'm going to be there?
You can just show up.
And when people enter, you say you ask them to wear a mask. Do they need to leave the mask on the whole time that they're touring the museum?
They do.
What are the highlights? Are there any new exhibits that people are now finally getting to see?
Well, the best news was that we were able to extend the El Greco exhibition. It opened just before we had to close. I think it literally opened the week that we had to close. And so the El Greco exhibition, Ambition and Defiance, is extended through October 19th. That's at the top of the Grand Staircase. One of my favorites is an exhibition on the modern African artist Mulligatawna. That is over in the modern wing. And then, of course, we do have a Monet exhibition that's going to be opening in September. So.
Are the Obamas coming there, the Obama portraits? Are they going to be at the Art Institute?
Next summer.
I saw that and thought, wow, are you guys going to have lines for that? Now you're going to have to figure out how to manage that crowd.
So funny that you say that, John. We normally, lines are a big sign of enthusiasm, and we really embrace them, and that was actually one of the new things we needed to embrace in these times is to make sure that we didn't have lines, and I think we've made all the necessary steps to ensure that. We actually have a queueless system set up so that you can text to get a place in line, and you can wander the galleries on your own and then be alerted when it's your turn to head back to the exhibition. So we tested it out yesterday. It worked pretty well, and we think we'll have it all down, especially when El Greco and Monet are on at the same time.
Free until August 3rd. Afterwards, you'll pay. If you've got a membership, just show up. Have your masks ready and enjoy one of the great institutions in America, the Art Institute. Okay, Amy, good luck to you all, and thanks for joining us. Congrats on opening up.
Thank you so much, John. Really appreciate it.
Amy Allen's the Vice President of Engagement and the Associate Vice President for Individual Giving. Not a bad place to give to. The Art Institute's website is artic.edu. Steve Bertrand has your Wintrust Business Minute.
Wind the clock. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, your daily roundup of Chicago area business news. Mission South Chicago Marijuana Dispensary is reopening today. It's been closed for 2 months because of the damage suffered during the violent protest over the death of George Floyd. The future of Arlington International Racecourse looks bleak. The CEO of Churchill Downs said yesterday that the land is more valuable than the business at this point. He says sports wagering on site wouldn't help. And GoGo, which provides Wi-Fi on aircraft, says it's cutting 143 jobs. That's about 15% of its workforce. Air travel has picked up, but that recovery has stalled. That's the Wintrust Business Minute. I'm Steve Bertrand.
On the agribusiness front, this is Orion Samuelson.
And here are the numbers at noontime. The September wheat contract is trading up 1.25 cents a bushel. The September corn contract is unchanged, but the December contract is down 0.5 cent. And August soybeans trading higher, up 4.75 cents a bushel. Livestock futures, Chicago Mercantile Exchange. The August lean hog contract is up 30 cents a hundredweight. August live cattle contract up 70 cents. And the August feeder cattle contract up $1.57. And I have to talk a moment about another unusual situation we have going right now in this year in many of our rural communities. I'm hearing from people who get unsolicited packages of seed with their name and address on it, and they're wondering, what do I do with this seed? Well, the Department of Agriculture says two things. Number one, don't open it. Number two, don't plant it. It indicates that the seeds are being sent from the Solomon Islands and also from China. And there's a strong possibility, according to the USDA, that they could be introducing invasive species that could impact negatively our livestock and crop agriculture. So again, if you get an unsolicited package of seed with your name and address on it, don't open it and don't plant it. And that's your money on 720 WGN.
1248 now on WGN on the Wintrust Business Lunch. News in 12 minutes. Anna DeVlantis after that. Well, there's a number of groups in Chicago that give. There's a number of people that need donations. And there's also a sort of clearinghouse for that sort of thing. It sounds like a pretty good idea, and I'm surprised that something like this didn't already exist. I'm talking about Fabric House. And entrepreneur and former Chicago Bear Israel Adonijé is behind that. Israel, it's John. You're on WGN Radio. Welcome to the show.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing pretty well. But this is news to me now. Talk to me a little bit about what Fabric House is and does.
Yeah, so, you know, Impact House, Fabric.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, is the coming together of some of the city's largest givers and philanthropists and giving organizations. The notion is when we look at across these other sectors in manufacturing and business technology, like 1871, there's these hubs, these meeting places where people can go learn, mind share, connect, that are there in the same sector. And we really felt Chicago being one of the nation's leaders in giving, in impact, that we needed a space where, you know, those that give, those that make it their life's mission to give and support the needs across the city as far as education and food resources and you name it, across the entire spectrum, that there was a place where all that information, all those people, all of that work can be centralized and done. And that is the core of Fabric Impact House.
So is it literally a location? Is it a building where these people can gather and work?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have about 200 members. We, you know, unfortunately opened in the midst of a pandemic in March, but that allowed us to see the power of this group. Just our organization, our resident organizations raised over $50 million plus in support of nonprofit organizations, money going to support them, individuals, artists, people throughout the city that needed help during COVID-19. So just really a challenging time to open a work club, but the timing of this group itself, it just couldn't have been more perfect. It's, 40,000 square feet at Madison and Wells, right downtown in the city here.
Are you renting this space to these groups, or are you allowing them to use it free of charge?
Yeah, so it is. It's there's a number of different, I guess, models in as far as how membership works. It is a membership-based club.
Right.
You know, so if an organization wants to join with their whole team, you know, that would be one form of resident membership where, you know, we have, as I mentioned, 200 people that they work there. When the world is normal, they work there every day. We have over 15 conference rooms, 4 lounges, 10 phone booths, you know, all types of resources to hopefully help make your meeting, your work, just the work that you're doing just easier.
That's interesting because I think a lot of us are familiar with that sort of shared workspace idea now, but I didn't know, well, I guess 1871 would be an example, but I didn't know that it would be focused on a particular sector, say in this case, giving. Is it giving to the arts? Is it giving to food resources or education, or it's a mishmash of everybody?
Everybody. So primarily, as long as you're what we'd call an impact investor, you're a funder, then, you know, that right now is our primary our member profile, that you're funding meaningful work throughout the city. Legacy organizations like the Field Foundation, Woods Fund, United States Artists. We have an incredible group called Forefront that does a lot of work both with foundations, the givers, and nonprofits, the groups that are doing the work. And it's really everybody coming together to learn from each other, just to mind share. And then if you just need to come in just to find a great place to do work, perfect. We have that as well.
Israel, then, are you talking more about the givers, not the recipients? It's not the recipient of these funds that would house there, but rather the people that are actually collecting the funds and distributing them.
Exactly. Primarily, our membership are all funders. So you would, as we are also collecting a database of the impact entrepreneurs,
right.
We call them the groups, the nonprofits that are doing the work that need the resources. We're collecting that database as well, and we hope in the near future to open up an ecosystem, a network, a space for them as well. Again, I think the magic and where we're trying to go is that ecosystem, like the givers and the funders truly, and they have been, they work together to create the change in the city. They work together to solve the issues in our city, and we're just on this first phase of a space primarily for the funders. And, I mean, they do meet with the nonprofits all the time within the space. You know, it's what they do. It's
sure.
What the relationship
sure.
is, givers and receivers as well. But right now in the physical space, our members are just the funders.
Probably able to eliminate a lot of redundancies that way, right? I mean, on either end of the spectrum, either the people that are giving or the people that are receiving, it's sometimes frustrating for me as a talk show host because I want to shine a light on a lot of people, but sometimes I see people doing the same sort of thing, and I think you guys ought to get together and eliminate some overlap, you know?
I mean, you're spot on, right? As groups come together and more people come into the ecosystem and learn about what they're doing, the vision and the hope is that the entire sector becomes more efficient.
Yeah.
That we learn from who's doing it right. And again, no ego. For years I did an after school program. If you're doing an after school program that I can learn from, let me learn from you and let's work together because that's for the good of everybody in the city.
If the kids
in my programs, right?
Well, you know,
so the notion of becoming more efficient is really a big point.
I think an example of that is what's happened since COVID hit, and that is all of these charitable arms suddenly opened up trying to get food and resources to restaurant workers who were all of a sudden laid off. So this restaurant group has that fund. That restaurant group has that fund. Somebody else is doing something else, and there's nothing wrong with that. But if there was a way to streamline some of that, and again, this is on the receiving end rather than on the giving end, but even then, if there was some coordination, then you'd know who to give to. I literally did not know who to tell my listeners to go to. And when I said go to this fund, I felt bad because I was not mentioning somebody else, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and you're spot on. And I think in general, people who want to help have that issue. Like how there's so much, you know, over 19,000 organizations doing work in the city of Chicago, Illinois. Mm. Like how do you figure out who's doing that thing that you want to support, who's doing it right?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, who are the people? How do you contact them? So the focus behind Impact House is we're going to pull all that data together. A lot of that work has already been done and help people find the people that are doing the work that they want to be a part of and just become more efficient in that. You know, you're spot on.
This is Fabric Impact House, and the website is the FBRK, right?
Yeah, thefbrk.com, and you can learn more about what we're doing. And if you're a funder, you know, you can apply right there on the site and come tour the house when that time comes.
Yeah.
We'd love to have you in the ecosystem.
Hey, by the way, speaking of that, you were a standout defensive player for the Bears.
Thank you.
How do you feel about the NFL playing again?
Well, I mean, I think I understand that when you have a business, at some point you have to reactivate the business. Unfortunately, a lot of businesses have closed their doors and have shut down during this trying time. And then others have said, you know what, I have to open. And, you know, the business of sports entertainment is one of those that they have to open. They got to get a product on the field. But I also understand the angle of the players, some of them who've had loss in their lives due to COVID-19, who have said, you know what, we're not going to play because
what would you
our
do?
Life,
what would you
our
do,
life,
Israel?
What would I do?
Yeah.
That's a great question. I think, you know, I probably today, as I sit here, would probably play. You know, I think I've had some conversations with teams and league leadership. I mean, they're doing all they can to really just make sure things are safe. Of all the sports, football is going to be the most challenging. There's so many bodies. Yeah. You know, you can easily kind of quarantine a basketball team or a hockey team, but you have like 75 guys on a roster, all the training staff, all the head, like, is a lot of bodies that all leaving the facility, going somewhere, and just the contact tracing is tough. So NFL they have a tall task ahead of them, but they have the resources. They have a lot of brain power. They're putting a lot of smart guys around trying to figure out how can they make it to and through a season. And it's going to be challenging, but, you know, we're going to see what happens and how they handle, you know, that first case. That's going to be really the test, and we'll set the difference.
I think what baseball's teaching them right now is when that first case happens, and it will, what's your contingency? Already have plan B and C ready to go so that it's turnkey, because you can't be making it up as you go along.
Yeah, exactly. Would you play?
I was a field goal kicker in high school. Thanks for asking. As a field goal kicker, I'd be happy to stand on the sidelines, trot out, nobody get near me, and then I would trot back over to the side. But I understand the pressure from the fan base. The economic pressure, it's not a small issue. I'm out of time.
Yeah, a lot of fans are upset. A lot of fans are upset.
Well, the FBRK, it's one fancy way to spell fabric, the FBRK.com. Yeah. Israel, nice to talk to you. Congratulations. Great idea.
It's a pleasure. Thank you. Take care.
Stay well. Would I play? They wouldn't have me.